Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by Oska Wellness. That's OSKAWellness.com, the coolest product in pain relief. Tough man, try. RunCatalina.com. We got the Catalina Eco Marathon coming up on Saturday, November 19th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $75 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. And as always, endurance lives here. She is the author of a brand new book called Chasing the Elements, The Heart and Soul of Action Sports. And her name is Liv Williams. Liv, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you, Bob. How are you?
I am wonderful. So I love iliveextreme.com. You are a crazy woman.
Well, I try. I try very hard to be as crazy as possible.
I think
we Brits are a little bit crazy anyway, so
you are.
I try up a notch.
So talk a little bit about when did you realize that, you know what, these standard sports or I want to do other things, and I'm just, there's something out there. I'm more of a thrill seeker than maybe my friends.
Well, it was quite early on, actually. So I remember being at school and getting involved in sort of the humdrum sports that you might find at school. Well, humdrum in the UK anyway. I think you guys over there have got a better assortment than we might have. But, you know, like sort of hockey and netball and sort of field sports and things. And I remember thinking, I can do these things, but I'm not sure I'm a good team player, generally speaking.
I'm
a lot better now that I'm older, you know. But at the time, I remember thinking, like, this isn't testing me physically. I don't know where my boundaries lie. I'm not sure where I begin to sort of, you know, create my own sense of myself. And the conclusion I came to is that I really needed to push myself in a completely new and different direction. And that's when I was about 17, and I remember going to the local university sort of sports center and seeing a poster on the wall saying that there was a new triathlon club starting up. And I thought, oh, triathlon, that sounds, you know, I knew a little bit about it. And I thought, that sounds difficult. That sounds up my street.
Yeah.
And so I went along, and there was a guy there called Pete Jenkins, who was in the UK senior team. And he was absolutely fantastic, and I fell in love with it straight away because it was a lot harder than anything I'd done before. And it was so much about testing myself against myself. You know, I couldn't lean or rely on any teammates.
Right.
So it was, if I did something wrong or I didn't do very well, it was my own fault, and I enjoyed that element of it.
So at the age of 17, is that when you went to Slovakia?
Yes. Oh, that story, yes, that's right. So around, that must have been about 17, I was brought up in the sort of dark depths of Wales.
Yeah.
Not really any neighbours around, sort of halfway up on a mountain next to a big forest. And so it was quite an effort, actually, to get from there to London, especially when you're 17. I remember going and being dropped off there. And I went to Victoria Coach Station, and I inquired with the driver. I said, hey, is this the guy, this is the coach to Poprad in Slovakia? And he said, yes, hop on. I thought, great, I'm being met at the other end. How difficult could this be?
Right.
Well, it turns out it can be very difficult. So I sat on the coach. It was about 36-hour drive.
Oh, my God.
And I got to the destination, and we all got booted off, sort of kicked off the bus. And I remember looking around thinking, this isn't what I expected.
Right.
And then I saw a sign that said, Bratislava. And I thought, Bratislava, I'm not meant to be there. I'm supposed to be in Poprad. Well, to cut a long story short, it turns out that at the age of 17, I'd got on the wrong bus in London, driven for 36 hours, was hours and hours and hours away from where I was supposed to be collected.
Oh, my God.
I got off the bus, and it was getting dark. I had no local money. And this group of, I can only describe them as Romani gypsies, came up to me and surrounded me and were asking me all sorts of things in sort of the local tongue. I had no idea what they were saying. And I think, I'm pretty sure they continued to hex me when I didn't give them any money. And I remember sitting down and crying and thinking, oh, I'm never going to get out of this situation. I don't even know what to do. I hadn't figured out at that sort of tender age that I had a degree of resilience within me. So I cried a little bit, and then out of nowhere, and thank God, this Australian young woman came up to me and she said, are you all right, mate? I was like, oh, thank God, you speak English. No, I'm not all right. I'm not meant to be here. I don't know how to get to the next city. And she said, oh, it's okay. My mum is from Slovakia. I speak Slovak.
Oh, my God.
I'll sort it out for you. She put me on the right bus, and then everything was A-okay after that. But it was a heart-wrenching moment for a while, I can tell you.
Well, and when I look at your background in terms of being in, you know, war zones, natural disasters, was filmmaking something that you knew you wanted to get into fairly early?
No. So a lot of the things I've done in my life have been, I would describe it as I've sort of gone through the back door into what I've ended up doing. So I did an undergraduate degree in French and Italian.
Okay.
And everyone would say to me, oh, so you want to be an interpreter or a teacher or a translator? And I remember saying, no, I don't want to do any of those things. Well, what do you want to do? I have absolutely no idea.
You just knew you wanted to do that.
I just didn't know. I wasn't one of those people who had said from a very young age, oh, I want to be a doctor, or I want to be a nurse, or I want to be a teacher. I had just no idea, and I was interested in so many different things and had a passion for all kinds of different things. So it was quite tough to identify one thing. And I remember I went and lived and worked in New Zealand for 6 months. And when I came home, my boyfriend at the time said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I think the only thing I can do at this point is try lots of different things on for size. And so I went to work at the local BBC radio station, which I enjoyed a lot. And I thought, well, I could kind of see myself doing this. I didn't know what kind of roles there were in media production at that point. But I thought to myself, well, if I want to see where this could go, I need to do it properly. So like Dick Whittington, I sort of put a sandwich in a neckerchief and slung a stick over my shoulder, and I went to London and moved to London and just was absolutely adamant that I wanted to work at the BBC and I would get my foot in the door any way I knew how. And I was lucky in that I got quite a sort of lowly position at the BBC and was able then to work my way up through all the different departments and into production, into the newsroom and current affairs and some big BAFTA award-winning documentaries. And really, that's sort of where the career I'm now enjoying came from.
So when I look at some of the things, you know, you filmed in the Philippines after the typhoon, refugee camps in Iraq, Kurdistan, and Turkey, and Syria as well.
Yeah.
When you look back at that now, are there times where you thought, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get out of here?
Not really. I mean, before you go, you really want to make sure that you're as prepared as you can possibly be. And, you know, I remember going on courses and being taught by my colleagues around me about, you know, what to do when there's a gun put in your face in a hostile environment, what to do if you're kidnapped, what to do if you need to run for your life,
wow,
those types of scenarios. And yes, of course, you know, those thoughts and those situations aren't to be taken lightly, but really if you give too much thought to them, you'll never get on the plane. So you need to be as prepared as you possibly can. And then when you get there, you hit the ground running and you get on with your job. And so, no, I've never been in any of those environments and thought, I need to get out of here. I've been in a hotel where I thought this is too close to, you know, the UK and the US embassy, because the fallout from a car bomb, we're within the fallout zone, so we need to probably move hotels, that kind of thing. But you go into a very interesting mental state when you're in situations, you know, sort of hostile or potentially hostile situations abroad. You go into this sort of constantly assessing, constantly forward-thinking and planning mode. And so luckily, to date, touch a large piece of wood, I haven't been in a situation where I've really needed to use the skills I've learned for, you know, evading capture or anything like that.
So probably you walk into a room and you're already looking for, okay, where are the exits at? You look at things, I'm sure, a lot differently than most of us do.
You do, and, you know, you'll go and test the fire exits. You'll formulate with your team members, you'll formulate a hibernation plan. So if suddenly there's a civil riot outside, or the hotel windows are blown to smithereens because there's been a car bomb outside, or, you know, any of those sorts of situations, you make sure that you know straight away what your plan is and what your teammates will be doing if you're not with them at the time. So you'll formulate a hibernation plan. You will follow that plan to, you know, follow every single point in that plan. You'll use your satellite phone. You'll do whatever you need to do that's in that plan to keep yourself safe and then hopefully get evacuated.
Is there one story that you look back on that you're proudest of that you actually brought to life?
I'm so happy to have been able to meet all of the people, the sort of local people I've met in all of the countries I've been to, in all of the disasters I've attended. One of the things that I've really enjoyed is in my filmmaking being able to, hopefully, you know, the audience will be the best judge, but hopefully bring to life the fact that although people have seen horrendous things, although they're traumatized and they've come out the other side, hopefully, of a very, very traumatic event, which, to be honest, has probably changed their lives. They've lost loved ones, potentially. You know, that happens all the time. They've lost their livelihoods. One of the things I've been proud to be able to show to the rest of the world is the fact that although those things have happened, they also are full of hope. They're very resilient, and they have this wonderful spirit of being able to identify what the important things in life are. So if you have your family, if you have your loved ones nearby, that's actually what's really important. And the other things come. So you can begin to rebuild a house from local materials. You can begin to identify where your food might be sourced from. You know, people, you know, whether it's a flood or a natural disaster in the States or in the UK or in a third world country, we are all part of the same community. So I've been proud and happy to be able to show people that we are one big community, no matter where we were born or where we live.
Is there one moment that was your scariest experience during all of the natural disasters that you've been at?
So when I went to Nepal last year in 2015 after the enormous earthquake that you know everyone will have been aware of, the earthquake that happened, I believe it was if memory serves, on a Saturday, and I flew into Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal, on the Tuesday, with some of my team members who had already flown in sort of on the Sunday. And I landed, and I was you're given very, very strict protocols in when you're doing humanitarian relief and disaster relief. And so one of my protocols was you don't leave the airport until your colleagues have come to pick you up. And so I was waiting at the airport, a lot of people running around, you know, normal airport scene, and my colleagues didn't show up. And I thought, something's going on here, because this is very, very unusual. You sure. always show up for one another. And I called HQ back in the UK, and I said, hey, you know, where are the guys that are meant to come and get me? And they said, Liv, what on earth are you doing there? I said, what do you mean? And they, I was a little bit annoyed. And they said, there's just been another massive earthquake, and we were told that your plane had been rerouted back to the Middle East. And I said, well, no one thought to tell anyone on the plane. And so eventually we got through to my colleagues. They came and picked me up, and they were evidently shell-shocked. And I remember thinking to myself, sat in this sort of taxi with them, thinking, okay, I need to do my due diligence here. I need to make sure they're okay. I need to make sure that, you know, I'm analysing how able they are and fit, whether they're fit to continue to do the job. And, you know, they're very, very seasoned guys. They knew what they were doing, but they were evidently shaken. And that was the first time I'd ever entered an active disaster zone. So we were, the entire time I was there, which was about 3 weeks, is a sort of 1 to 2 to 3 week time frame for emergency response or international emergency response. So in the middle of the night, your bed would be shaking and you'd have to run out in your underwear into the garden where you'd designated a safe zone for everyone.
Wow.
And so I remember just thinking how surreal it was that I was standing out in the garden in my underwear, still sort of rubbing sleep from my eye and the ground shaking. And I'm, you know, you live in California, so
So
you know exactly what I'm talking about when there are
aftershocks
and earthquakes. It's probably one of the most unsettling feelings you'll ever feel in your life.
Yeah, because you're powerless.
Oh, absolutely. And even when things happen to you in life that, you know, aren't particularly happy or you hadn't anticipated, the ground is still solid. The ground is still, there's certain things that you can still rely on, like, you know, I can still breathe air today. I can still have food and water on my table. I can still call a friend potentially and talk them through or ask them to help me think through this dilemma. But when one of the sort of, when your foundation literally has moved like that, there's something eerie that you can just never quite get back. So I remember getting back from Nepal and for months afterwards, I was only talking to my friend about this the other day, actually, who had come out to Nepal as well. For months afterwards, we would still experience what we thought was an aftershock, even in the UK. Your body, it never quite leaves your body or your psychology of having been in that experience.
Wow. So basically, it's almost like phantom pain of some sort.
That's a really good way of describing it. It's a phantom...
earthquake or aftershock. Where your body just feels unstable.
It really does, and it's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre, and I've had a couple of times said to a friend, are you feeling that too? And they said, feeling what?
Yeah.
Like, can you not feel the ground's moving slightly? It's kind of shaking. No, Liv, that's the phantom aftershock again type thing.
So when you're talking about the things that you're doing, and then chasing the elements, tell me the genesis of the book, The Heart and Soul of Action Sports, and I was reading through the chapter with Tia Blanco, and it's Q&A format, beautiful photography. What led to the book?
The book, so when I actually left the BBC a few years ago to pursue a few other things and try and identify where my path was in life. And I went to stay with a friend in Edinburgh, and we were sort of brainstorming ideas of what I should do next. And it was a little bit of a difficult time because when you don't really have any direction, you know, it's a little bit upsetting. So one of the things that he and I came up with was, he said, you know, you're very passionate about action sports and extreme sports. You need to do something with that. And I said, yes, but what? What do I do? And he said, you love writing. Write about action sports. Start a blog. Let's figure out a name. And just get going with it. And so 7 years ago, I started I Live Extreme and just started writing about things that I was passionate about within the sort of action sports world. And I'd also recognized that there were a lot of female athletes in action sports, because it was still very much an emerging genre then, but not many women were commenting on it. And I thought, well, you know, there's a gap in the market. I could do that. I've got, you know, I've got a big mouth. I can, I've got a few things nice. I can say.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. Oh. And I remember saying to him, I'll always remember this. I remember saying to him, one of the things I would love for this blog to create in my life is to be invited to write a book. And it took 7 years, but 7 years later, that's exactly what happened. Mayer and Mayer Sport, the German
yes.
publishers, they called me out of the blue and said, we love your blog, we love your style of writing, would you like to write a book? And I said, well, yeah, I've waited for you for 7 years, yes, please.
And what's cool...
And that's how, yeah, what happened.
What I love is the mix of, you know, BMX and surfing and snowboarding and free diving and free running mm-hmm. and all of that. What do you think, obviously you've interviewed all of these athletes from different sports.
Yes.
What connects them? What connects the dots between these athletes? Because obviously a lot of times they go out, they're putting themselves at risk. When you go to play soccer or basketball or things like that, you're not expecting that I could have a tragic accident here.
Mm.
But these guys are living on the edge. And is there something that connects them?
And that exact question is what I've asked myself 1,000 times. And it's, I think I've managed to chip away at that question and maybe find a few answers which I've written into the book. But I think it's a really good question. I think the answer is that it's a mixture of things. So people who are drawn towards taking risks are also the sorts of people, I think, who will get the most out of the natural environment. So people who, Tia Blanco, for example, who's the first interviewee, she's a surfer, from pro surfer from Hawaii. She throws herself into some of the most dangerous waves in the world and has done ever since she was small. And she doesn't worry about necessarily about what's, you know, whether today may be her last day. She's enjoying the process of being at one with nature, and she's enjoying the sense of having that flow state within her
right.
as she's surfing. And everyone I interviewed for the book told me a similar sort of story. They were telling me that from an early age they had this sense of freedom when they were doing their chosen sport, and how they got so much energy and happiness from being, you know, whether it's on a mountainside or in the surf or running a mountain or competing, they just get so much energy from it. And I think when your passion can meet your career, so when you can essentially make a career out of your passion, I don't think you can ever fail. And that's one of the elements that's running through each of the interviewees that I've contained within the book. They all have such passion and such drive for what they do that it has forced them, in a way, to become very, very good at what they do. And they'll just keep getting better.
What's interesting is for most of us, you know, fear sort of limits us. We're scared of the unknown. But for these folks and for you, fear or / adrenaline, it fuels them. That's what makes them alive.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing you totally related, even if you're not you don't do some of the sports they do at that level, but you could relate because that's the way you've lived your life, that you're not afraid to run into a war zone or into a scene of a natural disaster where most of us would be, let me out of here.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone, if they were put in a very difficult situation, and, you know, hopefully none of your listeners ever will be, but say someone found themselves in a natural disaster and you didn't know where your loved ones were, suddenly that fear of putting yourself at risk is taken over by the energy and the desperation to find a family member or to do the right thing or to somehow achieve something. And I think we all have that within us. The only difference is between the people I've interviewed in the book, the athletes I've interviewed in the book, is that they're a lot more comfortable with that feeling within themselves. They're a lot more comfortable with feeling fear, and they're a lot more comfortable with feeling vulnerable when faced with very impressive, massive parts of the natural environment. And I think that's something I've certainly identified within myself, that is that when I feel fearful, it doesn't necessarily mean that I shouldn't continue and do what's in front of me, that I should stop in my tracks. You need to analyze, you need to identify why you feel fearful, because sometimes fear is just an illusion, you know?
No.
You can feel fearful because you don't like what doing this particular activity might say about you. You might feel fear because, yes, you're physically putting yourself in danger. There's a whole different, you know, fear is on a big spectrum. So I think it's really important when you are trying to live a very, very full life and a meaningful life, is to analyze what fear you're going to pay attention to and what fear you're not going to pay attention to.
What did you learn about yourself during the production of this book? Did you come away with something that impacted you?
Well, it's lovely to feel like I'm a member of a community of people around the world who love the things I love.
Right.
That's wonderful. Suddenly, borders don't exist, and suddenly, you know, we're not thousands and thousands of miles away from one another. And I'm hoping that, you know, when people read this book, it gives them that same sense of elation and connectivity that I had when I was writing it and speaking with these athletes. And it's also made me realize, because I've had to really sort of hone in on the question you just asked me, you know, what is it about these people that allow them to put themselves in danger? I've had to really hone in on what that is, what the elements of feeling really alive are. And in so doing, I've been able to identify myself the things that once would have made me very fearful and I wouldn't have stepped forward, as to now, yes, I might feel just as fearful, but I'm going to move forward and do it anyway.
So
because the fear isn't necessarily something I should pay attention to.
So what is next for you now that the book is out there?
So next, I have got a plan for a second book, and that will be similar to Chasing the Elements, this first one, but with a much bigger and different spin. So still within the sports arena, but with a different sort of more global scale. Mm. I don't want to give the game away
okay.
too much.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And I'm also working with a few universities to help develop the sort of international development scholars of tomorrow. So giving them some training in, you know, how to identify particular problems and overcome issues if they go on deployment and that kind of thing. Hopefully do a PhD in the States, actually, starting next year. So that'll give me plenty of opportunity, I'm hoping, to interview American athletes in their own nation. That'd be exciting.
Love that. And the blog, people can go to your website, just ilive.com.
Yes.
The book, again, is called Chasing the Elements, The Heart and Soul of Action Sports.
Correct.
And Liv, that book is available. People can go online and pretty much get it anywhere, I'm assuming.
Yes, so it's available on Amazon. It comes out in the UK on the 28th of October and in the States on the 28th of November.
Oh,
but you can
perfect.
Pre-order it. So, yeah, just go to Amazon, and you can also get it through any, you know, good bookstore as well.
I love it. Chasing the Elements, the heart and soul of action sports. The author is Liv Williams, who has a phenomenal and fascinating background. Liv, thank you so much for taking time. Congratulations on everything you're doing. And when you come to the States, you definitely need to come in studio with us.
Oh, I would love that. Well, I'll keep you updated. Hopefully I'll be there very soon. And thank you for inviting me on the show.
I love it. Liv Williams, again, has been our guest. iliveextreme.com. Check out the blog. We are brought to you by oskawellness.com. That's OSKA wellness.com, the coolest name in pain relief. Tough Man Try. RunCatalina.com. Catalina Eco Marathon coming up on Saturday, November 19th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $75 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on iTunes or on BabbittVille.com. Subscribe to our newsletter. And as always, endurance lives here.